thank you all so much for coming. Really appreciate it. So today, I will be talking about the phenomenal character of visual experience. So I will be focusing on vision and setting aside the other sense modalities. The question that I'm interested in is, what features show up in visual phenomenal character? That is, how do the objects that we see appear to us in visual experience? So I'm going to sort of try and clarify this with two examples. So suppose that I'm looking at a table. Here's one possibility. The table can appear to me to have a certain shape, a rectangular top, four legs, and so on. And from based on these features, I recognize that it's a table. Or, alternatively, the table could just appear table-like to me. So there is a table appearance in my visual phenomenal character. Here's another example, potentially more controversial. Suppose that I'm looking at a small stream or river. On the one hand, it could just appear to me to have, again, a certain shape, a certain perhaps width. And based on these features, I judge that I can jump over it. Or some people think that jumpable over or appearing jumpable over just does show up in visual phenomenology. So the river or the stream just looks jumpable over to me. Okay, so I'm going to assume that most, if not all of us, will agree that at least shapes, colors, motion, perhaps, and brightness, these are features that are part of visual phenomenology. I'm going to take that as quite uncontroversial. These are what I will call low-level features of visual phenomenology. But many philosophers have also argued that high-level features are also part of visual phenomenology, like appearing to be a table, appearing jumpable over. And on your handout, I've put down a list of some of the examples, just a small set of the examples that have been put forward. So these include sortal properties, both natural and artificial. So appears to be a tree, appears to be a teacup, and so on. Affordances, so these are properties that afford action. So graspable, climbable over, sittable on, so on. Facial expressions, causal agent, and so on. So some of these are going to be sort of more plausible than others, but I'm not going to try and adjudicate that for a moment. That's just the examples that people have put forward. What I want to do today is to present a new challenge against this claim that these high-level features show up in visual phenomenology. I'm just going to call it high-level theory for short. And what I plan to do is to show that high-level features supervene on low-level features. And because of this, I argue, we have no good reason to think that high-level features add something to visual phenomenology over and above what low-level features have already added. And because of this, we've got no reason to think that high-level features are part of visual phenomenology. Okay. I am going to start by describing, quite briefly, two arguments that I've been put forward in favor of high-level theory. So the most popular one, the most common strategy that's been used is the argument from phenomenal contrast. So, just gonna show you this. So I don't know how many of you will know what this is, but so the idea is, if you don't know what it is, then you're going to attend to its colors, and its shape, and so on. Now I'm going to tell you that is a rambutan, a fruit that's really common in Malaysia, where I'm from, but don't think it's common here, I hope. I don't know, I asked Karim on the way, like, do you know what a rambutan is? And he said, of course I do. And I just thought, oh no, this example's not going to work, but I'm hoping it does. So what the argument from phenomenal contrast does is it typically picks up on these cases of perceptual learning, where you learn what something appears like. So you've now learned that orangutans look red and hairy and so on. And once you learn what it is, over time, the phenomenology of your visual experience when you look at it is going to change. So let's go back. Does it look orangutan-like to you? Maybe. That's what it looks like when it's open. It's got this like white thing. It's really good. I really miss it. anyway,
you
so
get it in London.
Oh,
you can get them.
So on the handout, I've set out the argument from phenomenal contrast. So let E1 be your experience of seeing the orangutan before you learn to recognize it, and E2 your experience after. The key premise of the argument is premise one, which says that there just is a phenomenal difference between your experiences. That's supposed to be intuitive. And the argument goes on to claim that this phenomenal difference is due to E2, your second experience, having an additional rambutan appearance representation. So this argument can apply to any pair of suitably contrastive experiences, and an important bit that the argument relies on is that none of the low-level features have changed, right? So if there is a change in your visual phenomenology before and after you learn to recognize this fruit, then it must be due to the addition of some high-level feature. It can't be due to a change in shape or color or anything like that, because that hasn't changed. Right, so you can run the argument for any pair of suitably contrastive experiences, so learning to recognize pine trees or learning to read words even, and so on. And the idea is that this is supposed to bring out the intuition that there is a change in your visual experience. Okay. One, just going to take that note down. One objection that has been raised against this is that it's really reliant on introspective intuitions. So you can just deny that there is a phenomenal difference and it's just not really going to run. So I don't share that intuition, and this paper is pretty much my attempt at trying to explain why. But here's another argument that tries to support high-level theory without that same reliance on that intuition of change in phenomenal character. This argument, the argument from unilateral neglect, appeals to case studies of patients with unilateral neglect. Unilateral neglect is a condition characterized by severe difficulty in attending to objects presented in one half of the patient's visual field. So here's an example of what happens. So this patient has got left-sided neglect. So if you give them this picture and you ask them to cross out all of the lines, what they'll do is they'll just cross out lines on this half because they just fail to attend to the left side of the photo. And if you ask them to copy a picture, they'll just copy half of it, and so on. And it does actually extend beyond vision as well. So some patients just ignore one half of their body, even. If you ask them where the left arm is, they just say, I don't have one. It's quite unfortunate. There's one particular case study presented by Humphreys and Riddock, where they found that one patient was, as expected, quite poor at finding objects in the neglected side of their visual field. So present some objects to them and ask him to search for a particular object, which happens to be on the left side. And if you ask him to try and search for the object by naming the object or by telling him what color the object is, the target object is, they'll either not be able to do it or be very slow at doing it. He can find it eventually, but be very slow. And what this study found was that if, instead of searching by name or color, if you tell him to search by affordance, so you ask him to search by what the object can be used for, he became quicker at the visual search and was more accurate and more successful at doing it. So he could tell him, look for the object that can be, that you can have a drink from. He'll be better at finding it. So the argument from unilateral neglect takes us to show that the patient can visually perceive affordances without perceiving low-level features like colors and shapes. That's what the argument claims. So I'm going to come back to this second argument later on, but I'm just going to assume for now that, sure, all right, high-level features are part of visual phenomenology. Let's take that on board just for now. Here is a potential problem for high-level theory. What can't we see, then? So the list that I presented at the beginning was already sort of, I think, quite generous. So why stop at appearing graspable? Why stop at appearing to be the cause of the window breaking or whatever? Couldn't things and people also appear intelligent? Appear to be a philosopher? Appear to be made in London? And so on and so forth. So I take it that these features, the ones that I've just listed, should strike most of you as unsuitable candidates to be added to the list of potential features that show up in visual phenomenology. So I think it's on the high-level theorists to explain why this is. So why there is ultimately a limit to the features that can show up in visual phenomenology. And I think there is an explanation that the high-level theorists can take on. So this is what they can say. These features like intelligence, being a philosopher, and so on, they don't show up in visual phenomenology because we can't distinguish between philosophers and non-philosophers, for example, solely based on how they appear to us. So there can be no such thing as a philosopher appearance because there are no visual appearances that correlate with being a philosopher. So if I had a twin sister who looked identical to me but wasn't a philosopher, you just can't distinguish between who's a philosopher and not, just based on how we look. And the same goes for intelligence, same goes for being made in London, and so on. So I think that's why there are no appearances for these features. On the other hand, for take low-level features like redness, squareness, and so on, we do reliably discriminate between red things and non-red things based solely based on how they appear to us. If you don't think that colors actually exist in the world, then what you can say is that we reliably make color attributions to things based on how they appear to us. I think that's fine. But you can't reliably make intelligence attributions solely based on how people appear to you. And for the high-level theories, they can say, well, the high-level features that I suggested meet this criteria. So we can reliably discriminate between rambutans and other fruit solely based on their visual appearance. So rambutans are the fruit that appear red, round, covered in hairy spines and so on. And there are table appearances and apple appearances and so on. So the high-level theorist can have a principled way of limiting what counts as an appearance in this way. Okay, so that's fine. But there is an asymmetry between how we identify low-level features and how we identify high-level ones. Right? So I've just said that for low-level features like colors and shapes, we identify them simply by identifying the colors and the shapes themselves. So something is red if it looks red. Whereas something is a rambutan if it appears red, round, and so on. So our identification of high-level features relies or depends on our identification of low-level features. And this has to be the case if the high-level theorist wants to have a principled way of limiting list, I think. But still, the high-level theorist can be fine with this. They can say, like, sure, high-level features emerge in some way from low-level features. That's fine. But that doesn't mean that high-level features don't show up Sure. But what I want to press, though, is that there clearly is a relation here between high and low-level features, and I think the relation is one of supervenience. So I've tried to spell it out in this way, as I've printed in the handout. So two objects which have the exact same low-level features cannot differ in their high-level features. High-level feature F supervenes on a set of low-level features, G, if and only if there can be no difference in the high-level feature without a difference in the low-level feature. So that's sort of your standard supervenience claim. I've just applied it to features. I have added the end, though, that one cannot perceive a high-level feature without perceiving low-level features. That doesn't fall out of your standard supervenience claim, so I added it on. But I think it's plausible. So this supervenience claim, it's consistent with saying that there can be a change in low-level features without there being change in the high-level ones. It just can't be the other way around, right? So I can change the shade of the table very slightly to a darker brown, and that won't entail that the high-level feature has changed. But I can't change the high-level feature without changing the low-level features. And I also think that this is, you can also say that the same set of low-level features can give rise to different high-level features. So I take it that, say, this thing looks like a pointer. I don't know what you call this. But it also looks graspable. So I think the same low-level features can give rise to different high-level features at the same time. I think that's consistent with supervenience. So I think we've got plenty of reasons to accept this claim. Let's go back to the thermal contrast arguments, which, as I said, rely on cases of perceptual learning, typically. I think these cases just suggest supervenience. So after you see the same set of low-level features for lots of times, you eventually learn that that sort of correlates with a high-level feature or something. So that strongly implies that the same objects with the same low-level features will have the same high-level feature. So otherwise, you couldn't learn how to recognize something based on how they look. In the case study, the unilateral neglect case study, that actually provides some evidence in line with supervenience as well. So remember that the patient got better at visual search when they were thinking about what the object can be used for. This strategy did not improve the patient's performance, though, when the objects were oriented in such a way that their handles faced away from the subject. So they were just as bad as looking for it as the condition where they were thinking about the object's names and colors. And the experimenters themselves suggest that this is because by changing the shape or the orientation of the objects, you change their affordances. You change how they afford, what sort of affordances they give you to act on them. And so this is just, I think, in line with the supervenience suggestion. So changing the object's low-level features changes how they appear at a high level. Here's a further reason. To alter an object's high-level appearance, you just have to alter its low-level features. I don't see how else you can go about doing that. So suppose I've got a piece of clay that's been molded into a teacup, and I want to get rid of its teacup appearance. I don't want it to appear like a teacup anymore. I want it to appear like a chair or something. The only way you can go about doing that is by changing its shape or its color and so on. You can't directly manipulate teacup appearances, I don't think. So I think that, again, gives you a further reason to believe supervenience. But now recall the argument from unilateral neglect again. That argument is based on the claim that the patient of the case study was able to perceive affordances without perceiving shapes and colors. So that's why that argument was quite convincing if it turned out to be true, because if you can see something just by perceiving what they can be used for without perceiving their shapes and colors and other things like that, then that does give you quite a good reason to believe that high-level features are part of visual phenomenology. So what to do about that? And that clearly is inconsistent with supervenience. Well, inconsistent with what I've added, namely that you can't perceive a high-level feature without perceiving its low-level features that they supervene on. So it turns out, though, luckily for me, that that argument is not actually adequately supported by the experimental evidence. So I actually went back and had a good look at the case study, and someone else, Raftopoulos, has also come to the same conclusion. So this was what was happening to the patient. The patient was better at finding things in a visual field because they were, by thinking about affordances, this somehow helped them to reattend to the bit of the visual field that they neglect. It doesn't follow from this that once they successfully attend to that bit of the visual field that they were ignoring before, it doesn't follow that once they manage to attend to it that shapes and colors don't appear to them. So all that thinking about affordances was doing was to help this patient to attend to the field. And there's nothing to suggest that once they did, they couldn't see shapes and colors. In fact, we've got reason to think that they do, because they're not entirely impaired at seeing shapes and colors. If you show them objects one by one without any distractors, so there's only one thing for them to attend to, and they can attend to that, they can, without any difficulty, name you what color it is, what shape it is, and so on. So there's no impairment of their sort of basic visual capacities. It's just that if you throw in lots of distractors, then their attention gets, then they find it very difficult to attend to one bit of it. That's it. So I don't think it's true that the study shows that you can, that affordances show up in your visual phenomenology without shapes and colors also showing up. It doesn't rule out, though, that these high-level features do show up in addition to low-level features. So the high-level theorist is still, I think, safe. But they do lose a potentially really strong argument, but I don't think it works. Okay. So on the whole, I think supervenience is well supported. High-level theorists can accept it. So as I said, even though high-level features must be perceived alongside low-level features, the high-level theorists can still insist that they're there, even though you have to see them alongside low-level features, that's fine. Remember that I think the high-level theorist should accept it, because the reason why we got to supervenience in the first place was because we wanted to explain why there's a limit to the kinds of features that can be visible, that can show up in visual phenomenology. We wanted to exclude features like intelligence and so on. And I think supervenience gives you a way of doing that. All right. But now, though, if supervenience is true, now consider what I've got in the handout is discriminability. So this is the idea that your ability to discriminate between features, just based on how they appear to you, your ability to tell the difference between, say, a red patch and a green patch, that ability constrains what shows up in visual phenomenology. So I'm going to explain why this is. So this is, probably all of you have seen this before, this is just a standard test for color deficiency, color vision deficiency. So normal color perceivers should be able to see, I'm not going to point it out yet, a 74. Sorry if you can't. People with red-green, or a certain type of red-green color deficiency are very likely to only see a 71, because this bit here is a different shade of green on your left. It's quite neat. So the reason why people with red-green color deficiency CA71 instead of 4 is because they can't tell the difference between these green blobs from the red ones, from the red blobs. Right? I don't know if the color is showing up very well.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. So, for people who only see the 71, there's no difference between these colors. They show up as the same color. Which goes to show that your ability to tell the difference constrains what shows up in your visual phenomenology. So if you deny that, then what you're basically saying is you can see the 74 even though you can't see a difference between this. And I think that doesn't make sense to say. So this dimension of difference just doesn't show up for some people. It just looks like one feature instead of two. So that the greenness here just doesn't just make no difference to your visual phenomenology, it doesn't show up. Right. So either what happens is that these green blobs look exactly like these red blobs, or all these red blobs look like this shade of green. But the point is that there's only one color there. There's no, this, yeah, anyway. Okay. Right, so now go back to supervenience. High level supervenor, low level ones. Here's my thought. So are high level features discriminable from the low level features that they supervene on? I don't think it can be. So they appear to occupy the exact same region, no more, no less. Where the low level features are there, the high level features are too. They don't, yeah. If I want to discriminate, say, a cat from its background, what I do is I discriminate between colors or shapes. So I don't think supervenience entails that high level features can't be discriminated from low level ones, but I think it at least strongly suggests it. I was thinking actually maybe a relation of constitution might give me the result that I want a bit better. So if I say that low level features constitute high level features, then it just straightforwardly comes out that you can't discriminate between them. So take the lump of clay that constitutes the statue. Think it's right to say that you can't visually discriminate between the statue and the lump of clay. They just occupy the same space. In a way, they are the same thing. Some people think they are the same thing. So, but I'm not sure. Yeah, it just sort of occurred to me this morning, actually, as I was looking over it. Maybe I should go for constitution instead of supervenience. Yeah. So if it is true that if you accept discriminability and if you accept sort of this, because I do think that to say that high-level features are not discriminable from low-level ones, that's a different kind of discriminability claim. Because the original discriminability claim was about discriminating like one feature from its surround. But the idea of discriminating between high-level feature and its low-level feature is a bit different to this. But I still think that you can draw on the lesson that you learn from this to that. I still think it's important that to recognize that your ability to discriminate features does constrain what shows up. And if you have no reason to think that high-level features make a difference to your phenomenology over and above what low-level features already do, then you just have no reason to think that they're there. Okay. All right. So that's my argument against high-level features. Now I'm just going to move on to a couple of potential objections that people might have. The first one is, I think, basically an incredulous stare. If you're very convinced by high-level features, then you might say, Well, surely we recognize things as trees and teacups and so on. So I'm not denying that this happens. I'm not denying that visual recognition happens. Of course we recognize all kinds of things. It'd be crazy for me to deny that. What I do deny is that visual recognition has to be explained by a change in visual phenomenology. So I don't see why that has to be the case, because I can just say that I recognize that something is a chair based on its low-level features. Some high-level theorists don't like this because they think that that involves some sort of inference. So I infer from the low-level features that it has this high-level feature, and they think that that's not right because it seems so immediate and so perceptual. I just look at it and I know it's a chair. So calling that an inference doesn't seem to work. I do quite sympathize with that idea. I think my response to that is to say, maybe visual recognition doesn't have to be thought of as an inference. So sure, visual recognition can be very fast and very quick, and in a way that seems non-inferential. I can grant that, but I still don't see why you need to explain our ability to recognize things by saying that there's been a change in how things appear to you. So you don't need to add chair appearances in order to recognize chairs. So here's another similar objection you can press. So say you're a chess expert and you recognize from the arrangement of the pieces on the board that it's an opening called the Queen's Gambit. And a lot of people think that chess experts, for them, the chessboard just looks different. So they look at the chessboard and think, Queen's Gambit, it's got a Queen's Gambit appearance, so on. And it's precisely because the chessboard has a Queen's Gambit appearance that causes the chess expert to make a particular move. Now, you could shift one of the pieces, like a centimeter, and it would still have a Queen's Gambit appearance. So you might say that it's not right to explain why the chess expert makes the move that she did because of the low-level features, because of the arrangement of the shapes and colors, the shapes of the pieces and so on. It's got to be because that the right level of explanation here is that it looks Queen's Gambit-like, not that it looks arranged a certain way. So it's not the shapes of the pieces and the board that causes them to make a move, it's Queen's Gambit. Again, I think, sure, but I still don't think you need to add that Queen's Gambit appearance to explain why the chess expert makes the move that she does. Again, I think it's fine to say that the chess expert recognizes the pieces as a Queen's Gambit opening, and that causes her to make a move. So this has a sort of parallel to the mental causation debate, if any of you are familiar with that. And yeah, well, someone just pointed out to me that there was a parallel, so I'm just going to throw it out there. I haven't really thought about what that does, but okay. So one of the objections that I thought of is this. The duck-rabbit figure. So this seems to provide some sort of evidence of a change in visual phenomenology. So from duck to rabbit, that isn't accounted for by a change in low-level features. So if you sort of see this as ears and you see it as a rabbit, and here's a beak and it looks like a duck and so on. They're mutually exclusive, so you can't see it as a duck and a rabbit at the same time. Sort of it flips between those. too, and that flip seems to be a change in high level features that just isn't accompanied by a change in the low level features. That seems to be a problem for the supervenience claim. It's sort of an improved version of the phenomenal contrast argument, perhaps. So I think I'm more convinced by this, by phenomenal contrast examples. The change just is quite vivid, I think. I'm not too sure what I want to say about this yet. I've only thought about it quite recently. I think that perhaps a shift in your attention might have something to do with it. I'm not sure. So I might have to build in something like your attention can also affect what shows up in visual phenomenology, not just low-level features, but how you attend to it might also affect it. But that might be a way of explaining this without saying that you first see the high-level feature duck and then you see the high-level feature rabbit and so on. Yeah, so if any of you have any thoughts on this, that would be very welcome. And with that, thanks, that's it.